It's time for TWiT this week in tech. Wow, there's a lot to talk about. Google's got glass. They've got an expensive computer. There's a new Galaxy S4. There's a new Galaxy 8-inch tablet. And, of course, the PlayStation 4. We've got the crew to talk about it. Brian Brushwood, Mike Elgin, and Andy Iannocco are here. TWiT is next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Audio bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by the new Winamp for Android, featuring wireless sync and one-click iTunes import. Now with free daily music downloads and full-length CD listening parties. Download it for free at winamp.com/android. Video bandwidth for TWiT is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 394, recorded February 24th, 2013. Math has sold out. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Warby Parker Eyewear. Get boutique-quality, classically crafted eyewear at revolutionary prices. For a free home try-on of 5 stylish frames of your choice, plus special expedited delivery, go to warbyparker.com and use the code TWiT. And by Stamps.com. Use Stamps.com to buy and print real U.S. postage the instant you need it, right from your desk. For our special offer, go to Stamps.com, click the microphone, and enter TWiT. And by Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell last year's gadgets. Find out what your used iPad, MacBook, iPhone, Galaxy S, or other smartphone is worth at Gazelle.com. And by Go to Assist from Citrix. Take control of your IT world from one simple cloud-based platform. Provide live or unattended support to all your users anywhere. Sign up for your 30-day free trial today. Visit GoToAssist.com and use the promo code TWiT. It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech, the show that covers the week's tech news. And we've got a great panel to talk about a lot of stuff. Let's start to my left. Mr. Brian Brushwood of Scam School.
Did you see that?
What?
Dude, that was me swallowing my drink just with half a second to spare before you tossed to me.
At least I'm weren't chewing steak or something.
Has that happened? Well, Who does that?
Me. Happens all the time. I'm eating. I'm always eating. Don't you know that?
Amazing.
I got to keep my weight up.
That's awesome, man. Yeah. How you been, Leo?
I'm well. I saw you, though, not so long ago.
Yeah, dude, we covered the PS4 event, which I'm sure we're going to talk about here. It's got a lot of implications as far as, like, you know, not only with video games, but the way we consume media and all the social aspects of it as well.
Yeah, Schwood.com is his website. And, of course, he hosts NSFW as well with Justin Robert Young right here on this very network. Also with us, let's go all the way to the right, because from Barcelona, where the Mobile World Congress is about to get underway tomorrow, we've got the peripatetic Mike Elgin.
That's a big word. I have to look that up. Peripatetic.
You are peripatetic. Well, the last time we talked, you were in Kenya. The time before that, you were in Greece. You are peripatetic.
That is true, and loving every minute of it. Yeah, I've been in Barcelona now for 3 weeks. So this is the great thing about living as a nomad. When there's a show like Mobile World Congress, I can actually move to the city. So we'll be here another week, and then we're off to Valencia. But yeah, the show, I went to the media event today. And it's going to be a really cool show.
Well, it's really good to have you here, and we will be talking about Mobile World Congress as well. Also joining us, Andy Iannocco from MacBreak Weekly and the Chicago Sun-Times. Hi, Andy. Getting ready for the Oscars, I see.
Yeah, mostly with this backdrop. Believe it or not, though, I know that the first half hour is red carpet stuff, which I'm never interested in. The second half hour is going to be Seth MacFarlane, and that's when you're overlapping that with episode 2 of The Amazing Race. Okay, I'm going to be watching The Amazing Race.
Oh my God!
Switch right over. Just switch it right over to the Oscars. I just know that
with all your real time TV watching. This is awesome.
Nobody wants to
uncle's place.
You don't watch the Oscars after the fact.
I wish that the Oscars were worth downloading illegally. It's like the Oscars is now at the point where you no longer have Jack Nicholson there in the front row. You no longer have like Godfather 2 up for an Oscar. It's no longer worth like even storing it on your DVR, much less downloading or time shifting it. I just want Spinal Tap at that Air Force Base. Let's get the Oscars on. Let's get it off as quickly as possible. Let's just move on.
Wow. See, and
the only reason to have the Oscars be live is because it's a social media event. To jump into the Twitter snark and like the whole social stream of making nasty comments about various things.
I'm also interested to see if Seth MacFarlane gets himself in trouble or not. He is the man behind Family Guy and Ted. I guess he's now in movies so that he can host the Oscars ceremony.
The thing is, like, he's the sort of like very shrewd business. Yeah. Like, yes, I'm edgy and antsy and out there, so long as I don't screw up my deal with Fox to direct a feature film after this Family Guy. But yeah, I've learned that I can say bad things about these five groups of people without bad mail, and so I'm really going to stick it to those five groups of people.
Well, there you have it. There's our Oscar coverage. We're done. That's it. But we will be done in time to get to the red carpet. Hey, I wanted to mention something. You know, we have a large and diverse community, and we love our community. It really is what keeps this show going and all of our shows, and we love you all. Last year, we had a guy who was very active, very much part of the community, Steve Lauren. His chat handle was Steven3X, and he was just really great. We had him in Game On, and he was a regular in the LAN party, and we heard a lot from him. Right, Chad? I mean, And he just disappeared in May of last year off the face of the earth. We just didn't hear from him. And that happens from time to time. People get busy in life or they get tired of us and move on. But we found out recently, Dan in our chat room, our chat mod, told me that Stephen had passed away May 15th. Mm-hmm. And so his last tweet was just the day before. It was very sudden. He was a young man, 42. And we found his brick. Actually, this is a picture he took of his brick, Stephen3X. So I just wanted to mention Stephen3X and acknowledge him. You know, I'm sure we've had other members of our community pass away. There's so many of you, but we just really care a lot about everybody. So we're thinking of you, Stephen, wherever you are, and we thank you, and we miss you. And it kind of explains what happened. He just disappeared, and we never really knew. So do us a favor. If you're going to die, just let us know so we can...
How about we do this? How about you do me a favor, and if you're going to drop a death notice on me, maybe before the show, a little of a heads up. Stephen3X was one of the folks I always noticed in the chat room while we're doing Game On Live. This is the first I'm hearing about this.
I know. Well, I was shocked too. I just found out about it yesterday. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to. I forgot. Of course, Brian, you would have had a relationship with him. Yeah,
and he was one of the folks who sort of stepped out of just the chat room and helped. I mean, he helped us put together LAN parties. He was a big, big help.
Now Brian's prepared. Brian has a website. Do you still do this? Afterlife.me?
Oh, you know what? Yeah, Patrick Delahanty, P. Delahanty in the chat, is the web wizard. I'm just the idea guy who waves his hands and say, I got a vision to make someone a virtual ghost and continue to essentially post previous tweets forever if you don't hit a dead man switch. And the idea is, this talk about like, oh, when you pass away, you have to clean up your digital profile.
There's nothing you can do. It's done.
Well, exactly. I want the opposite. I want to cause more chaos and mess stuff up. Because is a ghost?
Like the guy in Demon. You want the game developer in Demon who ended up causing a lot of problems.
Well, think of it like actual ghosts, if such a thing existed, are basically go around doing their daily stuff over and over and over again like they didn't even know they were dead. And so the idea with Afterlife Me was like when you croak, your ghost profile continues to tweet the kind of things that you tweeted when you were alive, and it's like nobody bothered to tell you that you're dead. And the problem was shortly after announcing it, Twitter got like way restrictive on their API use, and you had to be an approved partner, and they had to like your idea. And so that sort of slowed development on it. But I assume that you ask because of some of the other news that's related to this, right?
Well, go ahead.
I don't know it. That's
the loss of a Twitter client. One of our Twitter clients is dead because they reached the 100,000 user mark, and that's it. You can't add any more users. Is that the one you're thinking about?
Yes. Well, that certainly happened. But I also saw some news. There was a couple of feature articles that people had sent over to me that were similar ideas to what we were doing with Afterlife.
Oh, interesting.
They were probably all delicate and appropriate and didn't make a mockery of death.
Next time, would you put Afterlife.me on Squarespace? Because it's dead. The site is dead, which doesn't bode well for Brian Brushwood.
No.
So the idea this would stop tweeting after you pass or start tweeting after you pass?
It would start retweeting everything you said in life.
As if you were still around.
Yeah, still doing the same thing. You know, picking up the kids. Johnny was bad today. You know, the kind of things you would expect a ghost to say.
He's still alive. He never died.
Like everything else, this is another example of how William Gibson predicted exactly what would happen. In the 1984 cyberpunk fiction a novel, Neuromancer, he had this exact same scenario. The idea was that online chat, used realistic avatars, and he used artificial intelligence. So as you were using it, it would kind of half use your real chatting and half use artificially intelligent, you know, computer-generated chatting. And then somebody died, and the sort of the software didn't know it and just kept on chatting with all the guy's friends.
Well, it's my deep hope that by the time I pass on, there'll be enough video extant of me, and the software will exist that can take every possible word, every possible inflection, and just make a simulacrum. Because really, I say the same things over and over for the last 8 years.
Well, and so do we all. Right. This is what's great, is we exist as a feedback loop. Like, who we are determines what we do, determines right. who we are. And so we tend to have material. We tend to have predictable responses. If you're going to tell me about a new tax on, you know, internet,
I tell the same story.
My guess is you guys will know how I'm going to respond on this, right? So at some point, you could have an algorithm that distills and figures out before you even know what it is you're going to think about certain things.
Hey, if Tupac can give a concert,
we do a hologram Leo hosting.
I could host Twit. That's all I'm saying.
Peppersghost.com for the afterlife needs.
There you go.
There you go. Yeah.
I just imagine like people signing up, seeing like a link to a service like this on Boing Boing, and say, oh, haha, look, isn't that funny? And like I signed up for it. Oh, isn't that interesting? And then, you know, they forget all about it. Then 2 years later, they're hit by a bus. And now like all their friends, all their family who are brought just on the edge of falling apart because you got taken away from them so soon. Like, oh, who is this? Who's now tweeting under this? Oh, come on. Are you really doing this? I need this.
Brian, you're a magician, but you don't do the big stage magic. But have you ever done Pepper's Ghost?
We have, you know, obviously, very few. It's not practical for most magicians to do
it. It requires a big stage. It has to do with like a one-way mirror and. It's very complicated. Not even.
This is the beauty, is its simplicity. Now, it requires a big pane of glass. And if you take a pane of glass, hold it, set it up at 45 degrees, and you have one object on one side of the glass and another one at 90 degree angle, and then you just change the lighting. You bring the lighting down on one and the lighting up on the other, and you go from seeing the actual object through the glass to seeing the reflection of the object next to it. It's how the haunted castle works at Disney World. So it's like as you go and you see all the dancing ghosts swirling around, that's the biggest Pepper's Ghost illusion I've seen, where all of those are physical objects spinning around underneath you because it's just angled to reflect back the ghosts underneath.
Same way a teleprompter works.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
Two different ways of sending lies into an audience.
Haunted Mansion. Hey, there is so much to talk about. There's a PlayStation 4. We'll talk about that. There's some mobile phone news in advance of Mobile World Congress, but there's also some stuff we think will be coming out of MWC. Samsung already tipped its hat on a couple of things. Google is really pushing some new products. Project Glass, yes, but also the Pixel, really? We'll talk about that. This is going to be a good show today, so stick around. But first, I want to introduce a brand new sponsor. Brian, you wear glasses. I wear glasses, although I'm wearing contacts right now. Andy, do you wear glasses? You wear glasses, right?
I wear glasses if I'm going to be using my computer all day long. I'm not legally required to use them. I just wear them to look cool.
I want
to
tell you about a startup called Warby Parker. Have you ever heard of Warby Parker?
So I have not, and I'm fascinated with how savvy their launch campaign is.
They're
because
really
it seems like
cool.
They get the idea that the internet world is super connected and open to the idea of a new player in a long-standing.
Well, I'm not going to name names, but there is one company that dominates eyeglasses and eyeglass frames, and by their monopoly, or near monopoly, I think it's 80%, they've managed to bring the prices up. You know, I got last pair of glasses I got, frames and lenses, was $600.
Oh, geez.
It's crazy. Warby Parker, we're talking great designer eyewear starting at $95, including the prescription lens. They have a titanium. Oh, and I love this. The buy a pair, give a pair, where for every pair purchased, a pair is distributed to somebody in need. This is like the Tom's Shoes did this. I love this idea. So they're really helping people with this too. And you might say, well, I'm not going to order glasses online because I want to try them on. They've figured that out too. This is the Warby Parker try-on kit. So what you do is you go to Warby Parker. I'll show you actually what I did. First, you can do a virtual try-on, which is kind of cool. So if you see a pair of frames you like, I'll just let's skip that and I'll look at a pair of frames here. I bought some sunglasses here, which I'll show you in a second. But let's say I'm interested in these Benson. I can do the virtual try-on. Now, what I did is I took a picture of myself, and I can actually apply the glasses to a picture of myself to see to see how they look. And you get to...
So they were able to do it at an angle?
Yeah. They give you you get two pictures, and you could try all the... But now, this you use this merely, in my opinion... You say, okay, let's say I like this, which I don't, but let's say I like that look. Now I'm going to add that to my home try-on. I'm going to click that button here. And then, so we did this, and I got a home try-on kit. So let me show you what it looks like. So here's this comes to you in the mail. This is free. This is the starting point. You have, I don't know, a few days to try these on. And so you try the different glasses on until you find one you like, and then you send the box back. They pay the shipping, and you get the pair of glasses. And I got these are my sunglasses. These are prescription shades, $95. All right? If you want to do, they have some high-end titanium collection, start at $145 with premium Japanese titanium, French non-rocking screws. I don't know what that is, but I hear it's good. All glasses include anti-reflective, anti-glare coating. A beautiful case. I mean, they came in this gorgeous case with the eyeglass cleaner and all that. Beautiful case. So you're not, I mean, this is an amazing deal, and they can, and the truth is, this is what they should, what glasses should cost when they're done right. Now, I'm going to show you what I'm getting next. They have a monocle.
What?
I want to get the Colonel monocle.
You're already in the Dr. Evil chair. I don't know that a whole lot of people can rock. It's going to help your image.
Don't you think? Now, maybe I need the mustache, too. I don't know.
I think you do need the mustache.
Is that Joshua Topolsky? I think it is. So, I don't know. I just...
Dear, the big risk is that if you walk into a restaurant and you tip anything less than 20% with a monocle on, oh, boy, are you going to get spat on your way out.
All glasses include the case, the coating, the cleaning cloth. No additional cost. No additional items you need to purchase. You could try them for free with a home try-on. WarbyParker.com, WarbyParker.com. You get the special frame box, prepaid shipping label for easy return. I think this is a really great idea. If you're ready to get some new glasses. By the way, they just called my eye doctor and got the prescription. So that was simple. But they also sell, you know, clear ones if you don't need a prescription but you want to get some nice shades. These are polarized sunglasses. I'm going to keep these in the car because my regular glasses are transitions, which don't darken when you're in a car, which means them completely useless. So I'm just taking them off and I'll put these on. WarbyParker.com. Use the offer code TWIT, by the way, when you buy for free expedited delivery. WarbyParker.com. Use the offer code TWIT on checkout if you would so that we get credit.
So now that the ad is 100% over, yes. We're back to content. Isn't there rumors that that those guys were going to be associated with the Google Glass?
It's not in their ad, but I heard that rumor too, that Google is saying, you know, we understand these are dorky.
I don't think that's the exact language.
I don't think they said that, but I think it's right. And so we're going to get some stylish ones. And the rumor was that Warby Parker, as a startup, it would make sense, an entrepreneurial startup, that they would be the... One's tapped, and that's what the rumor was, yeah. So you've heard the name before.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm excited to see how they do because that they're, you know, we've seen other companies come in and do a savvy campaign to hit the internet crowd before, and it's worked well for them. And yeah. So I hope to hear the same thing about Warby Parker.
Dario Strange writing about that in PC Magazine. So
there you go. You know, there's an alternative to them just helping with the design, which is that you go and order your glasses and you pick them through the same process and then you click a checkbox that says
exactly.
Go ahead and add the Google
add
Glass.
Google Glass.
Exactly. Add $1,200.
Let's talk about glass because I was perhaps a little outspoken on This Week in Google this week where I'm just starting to think this is such a stupid idea.
Oh, no, it isn't.
Okay. I'm waiting for you to talk me down, Andy.
I'm saying as a $500 device that they're trying to sell 5 million copies of. Yeah, it's a stupid device. As a hopefully the price will come down to a reasonable $1,000, he said, ho, ho, ha, ha. It's a cool item. The video that they released this week, which The Verge said was pretty much the real deal when you're actually wearing
Joshua it. Because Joshua got to wear them. He got to go to the Google office.
Instantly. I wonder if he just, like, his heart just, like, skipped three beats as he realized that as every single tech journalist in the world suddenly started hating him for exactly 3.5 minutes. for that kind of jealousy has to have sort of a feedback loop to it.
I was going to say, there was kind of a magic moment. If you watch that video from The Verge, there's this moment when he has the glasses on and he's like, they're talking about adjusting the display. He's like, no. Yeah, I get it. I see it. Yeah. It says, okay, glass 325. And then all of a sudden there's this moment he freezes and it's clear. Like, he realizes that just by casually saying, okay, glass, he accidentally triggered it. And Google Glass asked him what he wanted to do. And he's like, take a video. And then it cuts to the high quality video that he's taking from it. The quality of the recording, what I thought was exceptional for what I had expected it to be.
Here's the video that Andy was talking about. This is the video I think you were talking about, Andy, which is from Google, how it looks through glass. This is the first time we've seen the glass UI. Yeah.
It had what Google has to do is make you realize how your life hopefully would be enhanced by having this sort of device. And it has to be better than shooting first person video of you on a roller coaster.
I agree, because everything's taken from the vantage point of your upper, your right eyebrow.
Right.
Which isn't necessary. I mean, I have a pair of glasses that take video. Yeah. What's the big deal with that?
But the successful stuff is when you have the sort of Josh's videos, you're just walking down the sidewalk and you wish you didn't have to take your phone out of your pocket to find out, do I take this left or the left that's coming up in about two blocks? I don't know which one it is. These little micro moments where you have to take your phone out of your pocket, even if you had a smartwatch, you'd have to, like, pull up your sleeve and look at your watch.
But Andy, is that worth $1,500 and looking like a dork?
So here's the thing: the people
who'd be willing to spend $1,500 for that don't care about looking like a dork. They would enjoy being immersed in this technology.
Here's what I'm reminded of: the Segway. Everybody thought, "Oh, this is so cool! You just lean and it goes in the right direction." And what they didn't count on is when you get on it, you look like the most idiotic person in the world because you're 8 feet tall on giant wheels, and it killed the Segway purely because of the dork effect.
That's the perfect example, because remember before the Segway shipped, everybody was talking about how they were going to redesign cities.
Right.
It was going to transform human culture. And when it came out, it's like, well, dork, it's just a dork thing. And it's sort of like, it is cool. It's a cool technology that hardly anybody uses. And I think to a certain extent, glass is going to be like that.
Here's the two things you guys have missed. Number one, who this is going to appeal to the most are people who are not going to wear it in public. But instead, right now, when I am riding my bike, I go on these 25 miles bike rides. And when I get
a message, get a GoPro Hero and mount it on your handlebars. It'll be better.
No. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about when I receive an incoming message, I'm pedaling dangerously on the side of the highway, I pull out my phone and I'm sort of half riding one-handed, reading and trying to tap a message back out. It's like, of course, it makes perfect sense when I'm riding a bike with that. If you want to talk about the video aspect, where this is, the video they can't make is the video of how somebody was wearing Google Glass and managed to capture the police beating they took outside of the G8 summit. This is where it truly matters, because you wear a Google Glass, you are making a statement about your visibility to the world for what's about to happen with public officials. And I think that as a countercultural measure, it will become a fashion icon there.
But it's the same statement that you make when you hold your camera phone up in people's faces.
No, it doesn't.
As you're walking around, it's the same, the camera in somebody's face.
The difference is you can't make that statement all the time. It's not practical to be making that statement all the time. You don't walk around and have civil discourse while holding a camera up. Instead, you have that awkward moment of fumbling out or whatever.
Yeah,
and this matters.
The reason you don't is because it's socially unacceptable to have a camera in people's face all the time, which is precisely why these things aren't going to gain widespread consumer appeal. You're going to have a camera in everybody's face all the time you're talking to them, and people won't like you.
Well, I think that's Andy, go ahead.
That's why when I wrote about it a few days ago, I say we're going to have to make an amendment to the social contract that says that I'm not being a jerk if I tell you to please take those glasses off during any sort of social construct.
But I paid $1,500 for those glasses.
Right.
And I won't know what weather it is or what time it is if I'm not wearing them.
Then you definitely pick up the check for dinner. Thank you very much. I think that as a first, what Google has a unique opportunity in that they don't have to make this into a successful commercial product with the first launch. They're making so much money off of their main business that this product really only plugs into and enhances that they can wait for the second or third iteration before, just like the Kindle first cost an absurd amount of money. $450, but now we're at the point where it costs $60 for 20,000 books for free for life. So if Google can do that, if there are enough early adopters that can survive with the idea of I'm wearing this dorky thing on my face, yes, it costs $1,500, hopefully it'll be less than that, and yes, that it only has a limited number of features, where it can get to the point where maybe instead of buying a new phone this year that I was budgeting $200 for, I'm going to spend that $300 instead on Google Glass because it's going to enhance my iPhone 6 better than the new features of the iPhone 7 will enhance my experiences.
So there's a choice that you can make. And granted, the Google Glass will, by obscuring part of your face and being, you know, bulky and clunky or whatever, I suspect that Google Glass will be in addition to Google Glass, we also have the rumors of the Apple wristwatch thing. And compare, when I think about it from a functionality perspective, if I don't care how I look, and instead I just think of what kind of interface would I like with my data, the idea of a wristwatch seems so antiquated and so 1950s compared to the idea of an always-on heads-up display.
Oh, yes. Spectacles. That's modern. Let's all wear glasses.
What you'll have
is... That's not 18th century.
No. Because you're not going to... Apple's going to have a hard time selling people on the idea of, well, what does this screen do that the screen in my pocket doesn't do? Well...
It's on your wrist.
Smaller screen that you wear. Okay, but what can I do with this? How will this enhance my life in a way that adding a smartphone to my life changed my life and made it way better?
You know what's clear is that
the justify the use of the wristwatch.
The mavens in Silicon Valley have, for whatever reason, decided that the next big thing is wearable computing. Can we stipulate that?
Yes, absolutely.
That's clear. I mean, you're seeing the two big companies, Apple and Google, both saying, okay, we know it's going to be wearable.
And Samsung and HP and...
Presumably they're working on it too?
There's a lot of patent filings and there's a lot of production going on.
Are they right?
I think that they have their right to try. Everything is going to be a failure until the first wave of technology comes out there and people can react to it. The iPad was a success only until the next wave of next generation devices came by.
Well, and Microsoft tried for 10 years before Apple got it.
Right. And that showed this is what people were really wanting.
Right.
But also, as soon as the next generation of tablets came by, the tablets that were informed by the iPad, the world suddenly started asking, oh, wait a minute, maybe we didn't really want 10-inch screens. Maybe we really wanted 7 to 8-inch screens all along. And now the entire industry seems to be pivoting towards smaller screens. So I think that we need to have that first device out there that really shows that really puts that drop of water. And now we can see the ripples that then that occur from that first drop. And then they can adjust accordingly. Well, I think it's an exciting product.
Well, even more importantly, Apple is really, really good at creating markets. I mean, smartwatches and heads-up displays and cameras on your glasses and all these things already exist. You can go buy something or less like what all these things do right now. And most people don't do that.
I've tried a number of them and they're crappy.
Yeah, they're crappy. Apple's really just as media players were crappy before the iPod, as cell phones were crappy before the iPhone, just as tablets were crappy before the iPad. Apple's really good at coming along and creating a device, then marketing the hell out of it, telling its fans this is the one and only type of device in this category that anybody could ever need. And they create the market, and then that opens up a gazillion things. I mean, I've made this point in a column over the weekend, which is that with the iPhone, the iPhone isn't about the iPhone. The iPhone mainstreamed the idea of a multi-touch device. Now, multi-touch devices are everything. And Apple started it with the iPhone in terms of mainstream.
I would submit, that
might not be the best example, only because the iPhone was preceded by a long, long legacy of smartphones that worked great and provided an immense amount of value for their users. Apple just simply said, well, what if we base this all around a touchscreen and a better interface and made it more media focused than made it being focusing on than focusing it on the thumb pad and pushing email. This idea of wearable computing is different because it is almost truly unprecedented. Now, when we're comparing it to a GoPro or comparing it to some of these little cameras you can buy that are embedded in sunglasses, that's assuming that the killer app for this is first person video. The real killer app is going to be, again, the people who are riding on bicycles and do not want they need to sort of keep one toe in their electronic life, but they don't want to have to stop and take out a phone unnecessarily. Even someone who's just walking down the street who doesn't want to have to take out that phone every now and then just to see what that buzz in their pocket was all about.
Keep in mind also, that brings up another aspect of Glass that I think is truly unique in that it's truly private messaging. Because even if I send you a text and you're sitting, let's say you're talking to someone and I send you a snarky message about that somebody, you have to pull out the phone, smirk, and then set it down. All of that telegraphs and all of that matters in that very real social space. And this is a way to send specific messages. I think there's going to be an extraordinary amount of appeal to people who want to be able to have a secret one-on-one connection with another person to where you literally share your life and nobody else is able to see it.
Except when you're saying, I'll be with you in about 10 minutes. I'm just having dinner with this absolute loser that I'm hoping to stick the check with by SendGlass. So anyway, I'm telling you, I'm glad that I'm in business with you. Can you get this?
Sending.
I'm running late.
Obviously, it's less private for sending, but you understand what I'm saying, though. The idea of having a one-way conduit that that is always on, I think, is extraordinarily valuable to the majority of people in certain situations.
I disagree. And I think you're making a big deal out of pulling a phone out of your pocket. How hard is that? Come on.
Oh, dude.
Isn't the wearable computer already here? It's called your smartphone, and it's adequate.
Oh, my God. Oh, dude. Who needs an automobile? My horseless, my carriage works just fine.
It's not so hard to take it out of your pocket. What's so hard about that?
We're not talking about calories expended. We're talking about at what point do you have to stop what you're doing and shift your focus away from what you're doing now into another space?
Well, apparently people are doing it all the time. You can't walk down the street without seeing everybody buried in their phone.
That's the other thing. What you hate is the fact that for a moment they are completely offline in the real world.
But they're going to be that way. With Google Glass, it's just you're not going to know it. Everybody's going to be looking off to the right.
Because you won't know. Because you will walk down the street and not realize that nobody's paying attention to you.
What's good about that?
No.
It's polite.
That's the Apple. Google will have failed if that's how people wind up using this device. I think that there's a consistent message that Google keeps trying to send with this, and that's the way that this is going to succeed or fail. If they keep telling you that this is not a way of cutting yourself off from the real world, but a way of becoming more engaged with the real world, because it's a way to share things in the real world with your social circle, with your social net, without having to stop, take out your phone, activate the camera. Oh wait, switch it off of movie mode, put it back into camera mode, stand there, look at what you're doing on the screen. So many reasons why I was filled with three and a half minutes worth of hatred for Josh. One is that he stole the Louis C.K. reference that I put into my piece, so I had to pull it.
What did he say?
Louis C.K. has this great bit in his current act when he talks about how he was at a dance recital for one of his daughters, and everybody's not watching the daughter, they're looking at the daughter on video on their phone instead of actually watching this.
That's right.
And then of course, he goes on from there. But yeah, there is that point. So once as much as I disparage using this as a first person video camera and collection device, part of it is going to be once the price gets down to a certain level, the value add that certain people are going to have to say that I can be able to watch what's going on and capture it and share it with the grandparents and share it with the other people in my circle. That's going to be worth, if there's a $500 price tag, they're going to say, okay, I would pay $180 worth of that is worth that one feature. Let's see if the other features total up to $500 or more than $500.
To me, go ahead, Mike.
Okay, I'm sorry. Google is currently marketing this thing as a way to capture video from your first person, which is not a very compelling application, but that's the one that you can show in a video commercial. The most compelling aspects of this are the kind of Google Now virtual assistant. I'm going to interrupt you and suggest something. Here's a little bit of information about the building you're looking at. Here's the name of the person you just walked up and started talking to. Those are the kinds of things, the artificial intelligence. And the cool thing about that is they're being developed for Google Glass, but they'll be usable for all kinds of other things.
No, I agree with you. So I think Google Now is very interesting. I think Google Now is, in fact, designed exactly because they expect to put it on glass.
Exactly.
So the very practical to the average consumer reason for Google Glass is one thing. Never, ever have to say, wait, hold on. Hang on. Just stay there for a little bit. Okay, there we go. Like, that moment, nobody likes. And there are enough people who don't like it to the tune of $1,500 that I think that it's worth it.
I'm sorry, Brian. Ultimately, it's not about photography. It's not about photography. And the other thing about Google Now that I learned recently, I don't know if you guys have talked about this on any of the Android shows, but it apparently Google Now is going to be an interface or the interface for Google's home automation thing called Android at Home. And they actually have cards for individual, Google Now cards for appliances. There's one that showed up in some recent code for controlling lights. And so I think where Google is going is this idea where there's a virtual assistant that's always with you,
right?
Either through the phone, the computer, the glasses, whatever. And you simply talk and it gives you answers and it has agency. So it does things, turns off the lights, turn up the heater. Did I turn off the, whatever. And so I think that's where they're headed. It's the bigger picture isn't the glass. The bigger picture is this virtual assistant, artificial intelligence thing that's tied into search and the knowledge graph and all that stuff. That's what's really, to me, the most exciting thing about all this.
Although I should point out that Android at Home's first demonstration was the Google Q, which was pulled off the market before they could even sell it. And anybody who'd ordered it got a free one. And
I think
anybody who orders a Google Glass might get a free one too.
I would love a free one, but I think that this year's Google I/O we're going to see some pretty amazing home automation.
I agree.
Stuff.
I hope it does take off. And should say I ordered a Google Glass. I paid. They haven't debited my card yet, but I paid $1,500 to get a place in line, and I'll certainly wear it. But I just don't see average people wearing it. I think they're really stretching the case. I guess if you think it's something about, it's an experiment.
Yes.
Yeah.
Obviously nobody thinks it's the end game.
No.
Right.
No. I mean, and here's the crazy part is no matter what happens, this demo that we're seeing now that we're all excited about will look utterly ridiculous in 10 years, either because it's such a great idea that now it's like laughing at the first generation iPod, that giant clunky brick, or because it was such a terrible idea that it never went anywhere to begin with. It was like dorky 3D glasses.
You have to admire Google, because this is where they're really willing to act kind of. And they have the money to act kind of in this way with gigabit fiber in Kansas City only. But that would just look what that could do with automated cars, autonomous vehicles. Yeah, it's not here yet, but they're pushing the envelope forward with glass, understanding that these things are all, now don't make a lot of sense, but they are the future. And I'm not even convinced Google's doing it for financial gain, but I think this is kind of Larry and Sergey are kind of into this stuff.
It's a cool thing, and they can do it with the Google. The Nexus Q really demonstrated how little risk that Google takes by introducing new products.
Right.
That would have been a humiliating failure for Apple or Microsoft or Samsung or any other company to make a big splash announcing this product, then never actually shipping it because they suddenly realized that this was a terrible, terrible idea. I mean, this is every company has its own signature personality, its own quirks about how it operates. When Glass was first announced, where they're just showing off, here's the design prototype, and here I am wearing this mock-up and explaining how this thing is going to work, it got a lot. Google got razzed a lot for introducing this pie-in-the-sky thing that they don't know what it does yet. They don't know if they're going to ship it or not. And now they have really just a promise to ship at some point and a video. But the fact that they're not like Apple, that they're not going to just simply wait until they have something to ship and they know for a fact they're going to start selling these things, then that's when you find out about it. That they shouldn't really be dinged for that. It's kind of cool to see them start to play with this device and start to build their own enthusiasm for it. And now that we're in 2013 and we've been told that Google Glass will ship to consumers by the end of this year, it's kind of interesting because it's going to be fun to see what happens when 5,000 people have these and see what they do with them.
It was presaged in an early version of Star Trek with Ensign Wesley Crusher. Here's an early version of Google Glass. And he wasn't quite so happy. It's interesting that science fiction did presage this.
Well, mm-hmm. keep in mind, of course, that the minds who are designing this stuff grew up in love with science fiction stories.
Exactly.
So, of course, the predictions influence the response. But to me, even if this is the Apple Newton of Google, then I'm okay with that, because that means that in 20 more years we'll have the iPhone of, you know, glasses on your face. And you can't fault for someone trying to do something so bold and daring and adventurous, and especially
their R&D in public.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, here's a mind blower. The guy who's the main scientist who's behind Google Glass is also working on contact lenses that do some
now
of this
that I'd get.
Type of thing as well.
now you're talking.
That sounds like that'll totally work. I have full confidence in this project.
Sounds safe.
And that brings us right back to William Gibson, who predicted this as well in Neuromancer.
Well, we're rewriting the social contract. I think that there's going to be a problem when Google Glass is built into just an invisible option on eyeglass frames. I want it to look big and dorky because I want to know if there's someone who's looking at me who might be capturing video of me. Not that I'm if I know that someone's pointing a camera at me, there's a low chance I'm going to be shoving half of a burrito in my mouth when I know I'm being photographed.
Will there be a red light on it?
Yeah, what'll happen is we'll enter a new series of social contracts. If you ever read The Diamond Age, they presuppose the idea that technology reaches a position where people decide how they want to live their lives. And some decide to live a virtual version of Victorian era values. And so in order to accomplish certain technological means, they do things like have a parlor room, a waiting room where people sit and then they exchange cards and so on. So what'll happen is we'll see virtual digital assistants to where it's socially acceptable when you all sit down to dinner. No, you're not going to take off your glasses because that'd be dumb. So instead, what you all do is you have an app that's installed in everyone's eyeglasses where a virtual butler holds all messages for 30 minutes.
Wow.
And once every 30 minutes, it comes in, interrupts, and says, excuse me, I'm sorry to disturb you. Here are some messages that have happened. And then they get synchronized up and then we go back. We will adapt to the new reality of social media in a always on 24-hour, virtually directly into your brain environment. And there's no reason that it's necessarily a good or bad thing.
Meanwhile, Google announces a $1,300 Chromebook. The Chromebook Pixel. We thought this was a hoax.
Or a typo or something.
So the Chromebook's predecessor, the original Chromebooks were a couple $100, but they didn't have an i5 processor, and they certainly didn't have a 4.3 megapixel Retina display. It's actually higher resolution than Apple's Retina displays. Touch, even though Chrome OS doesn't particularly support touch. But it's still $1,300 for 32-gigabyte Wi-Fi laptop. What the?
Wasn't the original one $500?
Yeah.
I mean, it was actually overpriced because it was such a piece of junk.
Well, this isn't a piece of junk, but it's still running an operating system that consists of no more than a browser.
But the original one, the problem with the original one wasn't so much that it was a cloud-only device. They've actually done some creative work around that. It was just that it was a piece of junk. It would crash, and it was horrible. This is not that. This is a high-quality machine with a very high-quality display, apparently. And I think that it's three times the price of the original, but it's 10 times as good. I think this is much more compelling than the original, even at this price.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh. Than the original, I agree, because all the points you've made are completely valid. But when you compare it to the $250 Samsung Chromebook, which is a fantastic device, I applaud Google for taking seriously this mandate of putting computing power in the hands of everybody, not just the people, or at least the people who can afford it at a much lower price point than what you would normally have to spend for a laptop of similar quality. But it was so surprising to me that not just the price tag, but why does a Chromebook need an i5 processor? Why does a Chromebook need a display of this quality? Why does a Chromebook need a touchscreen or this build quality? Why don't you extend the battery life? Do a 12.85-inch Chromebook, but and give us a better keyboard and a better trackpad, but also find a way to make this the equivalent of a $900 Intel PC, a Windows PC, for like a $500 or $400 price point. And when I was talking to Google about this on Thursday, oh boy, I was asking the dumbest questions ever, because all of them came down to, On Wednesday, I didn't believe I lived in a world in which Google would try to sell a $1,299 Chromebook, and now I don't even know what the name of my mother is right now. I'm so confused.
That's why they did it, Andy.
Well, it seems to me that there exists, and keep in mind, I am not qualified to talk about this, but that will not stop me because I'm not somebody who believes in, you know, putting everything on the cloud. But if you are somebody who really believes in the cloud and believes in the Google ecosystem, my guess is it would be embarrassing to be one of these high quality evangelists and then pull out this plastic coated
netbook.
Yes, mm-hmm. piece of junk, and be embarrassed of your thing. This is a way for them for it to be socially acceptable to set this down right next to somebody's MacBook. And now it's not a difference of quality of build. It's not a difference of quality of processor. It's a difference of philosophy.
It's a statement. Saying, yeah.
Yes, exactly. And this is exactly what Google needs, I think.
Couldn't you be a better evangelist for Chromebook by taking that $1,300 and buying 5 Samsung Chromebooks every time someone says, "Hey, wow, is that a Chromebook? I've always wanted to try one. Here, take mine." Because all my data is in the cloud, it takes me 2 keystrokes to absolutely burn all my data off of it. And because it's so affordable, I actually have 3 in the trunk of my car right now.
Or buy a MacBook Air for the same or less and just promise I will only use Chrome.
Yeah, that's the disconnect point I had, where at a certain price point, I don't understand the argument against just buying a regular MacBook or Windows notebook and then just running web apps through Chrome.
So I promise only.
Maybe it's a lack of my understanding, and I just don't know why they did. And you do have a good point. Part of it is that maybe they really do want to have a prestige level product out there that really does emphatically say, I love Chrome so much. I love the Chromebook idea so much. I wanted the best optimum device quality possible. Maybe Google wanted to say to web developers, we will give you the ultimate hardware to write a web, target a web app for. Here it is. If you want to create the best web apps possible, you are not going to be limited by onboard CPU. You're not going to be limited by speed of input or display. Here is now. Please make us some stuff that really lets us show off Chrome. But
it's for the
market. I actually think there's a market for this, and the market is in the enterprise space. Executives. There are lots of executives who want something simple and secure.
I got it.
And in the cloud. And I've seen so many C-level executives who are flummoxed.
This is the CEO's laptop. Manager. You're exactly right.
Exactly.
You hit the nail on the head. And
okay.
Yeah.
It's not for you and me.
Right.
For the monocle crowd.
It's for the monocle crowd to buy for the top tier 2 glass wearing people.
It does make a statement if you buy this that you have more money than you really know what to do.
Well, but again, it's the base level assessment, but you also have the fact that what you're saying is I demand high quality. I demand high, you know, low latency, and I believe this can be done in a cloud-based service.
We're going to take a break, come back with more. What a great panel. Lots to talk about. Mobile World Congress coming up. Windows Blue. The HTC One. Is it the best Android phone yet? A couple of new 8-inch tablets showing that Apple might have led the way there. And yes, we got to talk about the PS4. You're watching Twit with Brian Brushwood, schwood.com, and from Revision 3's Scam School.
Yeah, and scamstuff.com. Now we got loot. We got bump keys so you can break into your neighbor's house.
You're not selling bump keys.
Yes, I am.
Isn't that illegal? Nothing's illegal in Texas.
Only in it's not illegal to sell from Texas. There are a few states that we cannot ship to.
Do you sell lock picking stuff?
This is George W. Bush, and now you're sending lock picking tools in the world. I can't have you guys. The textbook problem. It's like every source of horrible problem seems to be Texas, and I'm sick of it.
And you know what's great about these bump keys? They're only $9.99. So,
well, and we made them premium items there. Like you see, we had custom art put on those. We wanted them to kind of be status symbols. I'm really a fan of the Dia de los Muertos design that we got on those. and of course, we had them made, and I was paranoid that they wouldn't work. So the first thing, like I got back from a trip, I walked right past my wife, right past my kids. I grab one of them and I start hammering on my door. And it wasn't until I got it 3 times in a row that I was finally like, all right, we're good. We're good.
You are a madman.
Yes.
All right.
Sure. Let's say that.
All right. The Art of Scamming with Brian Brushwood. Also with us from the Chicago Sun-Times and MacBreak Weekly, Andy Iannocco. And from Barcelona, Mike Elgin. Hey, it's great to have you all. Our show today brought to you by Stamps.com. Why go to the post office when you can print your own postage with your computer, your printer? You don't need a postage meter. You don't need special ink. You need Stamps.com. In fact, I'm just going to cut to the chase here. Go to Stamps.com right now. If you do a lot of mailing in your business, this is really, I mean, you know, if you're just mailing Christmas cards once a year, don't get Stamps.com. I'll save you the time. But if you send a lot of mail, whether it's invoices or product marketing stuff, or if you send packages out, maybe you're a seller on Etsy. This is anybody who sells stuff on Etsy or Amazon or anywhere really should be using Stamps.com. This is professional fulfillment. It not only print stamps, you print right on the envelope. You print package mailing labels. If you're sending express mail or priority mail, they have discounts you can't get at the post office. It will send an email to your recipient with the tracking number, all of this automatically. And look at this special offer. Don't go to the front page. Well, do go to the front page, stamps.com, but don't go for that $80 value because we got a better deal. Click the microphone and enter TWIT is the promo code. And that $80 value turns to $110 value. You get that beautiful scale, the brushed aluminum scale, USB scale that'll always give you the right postage. You get $55 in free postage to use over your first few months as a stamps.com customer. $5 supply kit, 4-week trial, all for using the offer code TWIT.
I'll tell you this much. They saved, like when we launched.
You use it, right, for Scam School stuff?
Yeah, when we launched Scam Stuff, we did an Indiegogo to fund it. We did triple the amount of interest that we thought we were going to do. And there was this momentary freak out of how we're going to logistically do all of that. And then I asked around, like, who should I go with? And like the universally, everyone's like, do stamps.com, offer code TWIT. And so we did it, and it totally saved our bacon, man.
Yeah.
Super easy.
Do you have somebody who's mailing this stuff out, or are you doing it?
Yeah, no, not anymore.
You and Bonnie?
That's all. No, that's John Tilton, my my director of digital, as I call him now.
Good. He gets a title and a stamp scale.
Sure.
Stamps.com. Scale's yours to keep. Do try this $110 bonus offer, though. Use the promo code TWIT. Yeah, makes sense. All of a sudden, you got to mail out a bunch of stuff.
Yeah, well, and sooner or later, like anyone who has, if you ever find yourself, and there's a lot of people who at this moment are hearing this discussion or like, I don't need that. Just file it away because that's what I did.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, overnight, I needed to send out 500 somethings and I didn't know what to do. And it was stamps.com made it easy. They got the discount. You saved us a ton of money. Super great.
Just a note, Petro Vlahos passed away this week. He invented the green screen. He was 96 years old. He's founded a company with his son, Paul. In 1976, you might have heard of, called Ultimat. And without that, weathermen would not be, and women would not be able to predict the weather and point to the map. Dick Van Dyke would not have been able to dance with penguins and Mary Poppins. The blue-skinned Na'vi would not have been able to live on a floating mountain in Avatar. The green screen inventor passed away, age of 96.
Also the creator of the Dalek costume. Ray Cusick, C-U-S-I-C-K.
Is that his sole credit?
I'm sure he did other brilliant things, but that's what I'll remember him for.
It's a pretty wild costume.
Yeah.
All right. Moving along, let's talk about the PlayStation 4. Brian was here on Wednesday with me and Anthony Carboni from Revision 3 to talk. We talked over the PlayStation announcement, which was a lot of fun.
It was a bit of an MST3K moment.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there was, I think the gist of it came through with a little bit of extra color. People said nice things.
Well, if you want to watch the announcement plain, Sony streamed it plain. But what we like to do, and you know, this has become our trademark thing to do with keynotes and announcements, is, you know, we kind of gloss it. We annotate it. Irreverent annotation. And I'll tell you, during the 2 hours, we peaked, I think, at something like 55,000 simultaneous viewers.
Holy cow. I am so glad you did not tell me that while it was happening.
It was good.
Freaked out.
There was a lot of interest, and I'm not surprised. First of all, why did Sony announce it in February? June is when E3 is. That's typically when you announce these kinds of things. They did say it'll be out at Christmas time, but isn't it a little early to talk about it now?
Well, especially because they didn't show the actual unit.
They didn't say what the
price was going to be. Yeah. But from what I understand, that they did the exact same thing with the PS3 and with the PS2. Now, this comes, again, not from me, but from my director of digital, John Tilton, who is an obsessed Sony fanboy. So he said this is exactly how they do it. And I guess I just missed it the previous go-rounds. But they certainly did this. I mean, they set the stage. What normally is B-level supplemental material on what are the specifics of you could do with particle physics, what titles, what creators are on board for all this stuff, the stuff that you care about less than the big info, they essentially gave us the director's commentary track first, and then we're going to get the feature at E3, and they certainly supercharged interest in it. So I assume that if this is a method that they love to repeat year after or every time they release a new object, then I guess is business as usual, and they certainly did a good job of stoking the fire.
Well, and they also stoked Microsoft's competitive instincts, because the rumor is now Microsoft will also do a pre-announce in April of next Xbox. Yeah. So that
was not public until after the PS4.
Yeah,
event?
That's what we heard afterwards. Now, that's just a rumor. I don't know if that's confirmed. But Paul Theriot, indirectly of Windows Weekly fame, indirectly confirmed it by saying, yes, no, don't. It's going to be something before June, which is E3. Will both of them come out at holiday buying season?
I mean, it would be rampant speculation, but what else are we good at here at TWiT? I'm going to say yes. Both of them will definitely come out this year.
Pretty cool. But that'll be a battle in the stores. Andy, are you a gamer, Andy? I think you are.
Not really, no? Only because I don't want to. I make a living by doing this, and if I spent 8 hours a day doing this, I would need a helper monkey to help me do this.
I have
an Xbox, and I most use it for like home media and home entertainment, because it's become such a cool box for doing stuff like that. As a matter of fact, there was, of course, Microsoft Xbox team was tweeting earlier today saying, "Oh, be sure to tune into we've got extra special pre red carpet live coverage from the Oscars just 3 hours before you tune into the incredibly stupid half hour pre show on ABC. Tune into our own stupid pre show." But it's a great device for plugging into that kind of interest. Where you're not going to get the 14 million people who might be watching the actual telecast, but you're going to get the people you're going to get maybe 100,000, 200,000 people who are interested enough to really want to see the sort of nominees who work the boom mic on a best documentary short that are going to be showing up 3 hours before the actual show.
Here's the for those of you who didn't see the announcement. Here is the here's some video from the announcement.
Beautiful sound and pictures through my TV. What is it called? PlayStation. Video games for people who know and love video. I see. The system consists of this PlayStation optical disc player.
Here's exactly what the budget was. They could afford Nimoy. They couldn't afford Nimoy's price for shaving off the mustache.
This single wire.
At least he didn't have the pointy ears. I don't know what this is from. It's on IGN. It's obviously the LaserDisc introduction. With a PlayStation 4 theme.
Oh, that's amazing.
Excuse me. PlayStation 4 has the appearance of a highly stylized record player. However, I noticed the absence of stylus or needles.
This is on the IGN PS4 hub. I'm pretty excited. What's interesting about what they're doing, it is x86, 8 gigs of RAM.
I just suggest everybody watch this video. You get pretty much all the info that you got from the real thing.
Yeah, this is all you need to watch. They even had the games at the beginning. And
discs are played from the underside. Interesting. The encoded information on
one thing that Sony did not announce at its PS4 announcement is whether they would have a Blu-ray disc in there. Although now, subsequently, Sony spokespeople have said, yes, we're going to still be using optical discs for game delivery. It did say, which I thought was odd, We'll pay attention to what games you like and download games ahead of time that you might be wanting to buy.
I think this is a great idea because keep in mind it doesn't cost you anything. It's not space that is earmarked or prevents you from downloading other things. Basically, they know when there's a major release that they're going to purchase that there is an opportunity to get it pre-downloaded on millions of systems. And then when somebody makes that snap decision, because how many times have you had that where there's a game you heard about, you're like, I don't know if that's for me. I don't know if it's that great or whatever. And then all of Twitter explodes with like, OMG, best game ever.
Right.
And you're like, okay, I'm going to buy it. And you go to buy it. And it's like tomorrow morning, you'll be able to play this game. This is just them making bets on this is our bet on the kind of stuff we think you're going to like. And it downloads it in advance so that when you make that snap decision, it's already pre-downloaded and you're able to jump in right away. I think there's nothing but win in this. Especially
and presumably you could turn it off if you have bandwidth caps that would make this undesirable. Yes.
Right. Well, and also keep in mind, Leo, how many people only have like 1.5 megabits or even worse, you know, have some kind of DSL with half a megabit where it's like they would much rather have three. It would take them 3 weeks of casual downloading before they would get this thing done.
It also responds to a notorious problem with the PlayStation 4, which is every time you put a game in, you might as well have a cup of coffee because it's going to update. Constantly. Well,
they also, on the other side of that, they made it so that when you power it down, it doesn't fully power down. It goes into a sleep mode that sort of pauses it so that you're able to click it and go instantly on, already ready to play the game. I think there and
power
and
nap. Power nap.
Power nap. Why don't they call it that? That's a great idea. I also think that they did a smart thing with the most derided feature, I think, was the share button. But I also think it's the most savvy one because as Leo and I were talking about during the live event, the most surprising trend to me has been the discovery of how many people like to watch other people playing video games and to build it in at a base level of the console so that you can share your best kill or live stream your playthrough or whatever. I think as silly as that sounds to a generation that doesn't play games, or even the generation that does play games, there's an audience for whom this is going to be an extraordinarily valuable feature.
The button is right on the controller. You press the button as you're playing. In fact, they did it during one of the demos. They shared immediately to a Facebook page during the demo, which was very cool, that share button.
I think what people want even more than that, though, and I haven't heard anybody really announce this yet, is I think people want to see their friends' faces and watch TV socially, watch television, movies, whatever. Socially, I don't know if you guys are fans of Japanese game shows, but Japanese game shows do this when they show some crazy thing, the guy's being humiliated or whatever on screen. They show they have a panel of like celebrities or whatever, and their faces are there, and the audience gets to watch the emotional reactions of these other people that they care about. And I can see that becoming a kind of Twitter for television, whereas you watch a movie with somebody who's on the other side of the country, and you can see each other, and so you can sort of react and kind of you're in the same room enjoying this content. I'd really like to see something like that, and I'm almost certain that something like that is they have to figure out how to make television not only asynchronous and separate from the whole live thing and the seasons and all that stuff, but also make it a form of social networking.
I was going to say that what I like about that observation is that it taps into a fundamental aspect of the way we perceive the world, which is the importance of social proof. We base our opinions on things, whether we like it or not, on what other people think of them. And that's the reason we have laugh tracks on on Big Bang Theory. It's the reason that we value Yelp. It's the reason that we value Amazon reviews. And to build that in fundamentally and the ability – and in fact, that's something that's underserved right now. Because I think there exists a market for a class of media curators who decide to present content and give commentary on it while it happens. And the problem is with Ustream and Justin.tv, we see that there's software instantly shutting down whenever it's copyrighted content. But if we could have a structure where everybody's bought the movie and you're experiencing it as a group, it's yet another way we can virtualize the movie night experience that we've all enjoyed historically.
And it's why Twit has a chat room.
Yes. Yeah.
And so it's been very interesting, this chat room, because, of course, it's active during shows. But when Discovery landed on Mars, I'm sorry? Curiosity landed on Mars. People were in the chat room participating. During other kind of geek events, the chat room is a community that exists beyond just having Twit shows go on. And there's clearly this desire to kind of experience these things in a virtual space together. There's no doubt the Xbox was designed to get Microsoft into the living room. Sony,
yes,
maybe missed a bet by not putting more social into the PlayStation 3. They're not going to miss it this time. They understand that they need to be a living room device. Although they said something interesting, which really surprised me, that the number one way people watch Netflix is in their PlayStation 3.
Yeah, this was, as I mentioned, this was something we talked about on frame rate. And this is at some point for all these devices that want to bring streaming to the living room. This is what's great about the positioning of both the PS3 and for the Xbox is that they're already there. And by virtue of being overpowered for simple streaming, they are able to provide a super fast, super smooth experience. The number one way I watch content on Netflix is now my Xbox 360 in my living room. And the only reason it's not a PS3 is because I didn't have a PS3 until like last month. I think this is great. And I think it shows that these consoles are becoming something more than a place to, you know, get headshots in the living room. Which, now that I said that, sounds like something dirty, and I'm going to stop talking.
It's very dirty, but I think that the bigger thing you're tapping into is this whole. It's not only just sort of, you know, these game consoles are going to become home servers. They're essentially servers for your home that will control not only your entertainment system but also your lights and your home automation and sprinkler system and maybe even the security system, and they'll all be tapped in on the internet with like Siri or Google Now. And, you know, I think we're heading into a world where these living room systems are going to be super, super powerful. I'm really, really excited about the next Xbox, though, because of two technologies that seem to me to be really groundbreaking for gaming and probably some other things. One of them is IllumiRoom, which is Microsoft's technology for projecting environment of the game on the walls and ceilings and floor of your living room as you're playing it. This sounds like a really great idea to me. It's a really cool thing. The other one is that the next version of Kinect is supposed to be so refined that it can read lips and do all these other things. You know, it can see that you have a facial tick and like decide your emotions and all this kind of stuff. So that could be really cool for a lot of things as well. So one of the things that's great about these consoles is they're really driving some pretty interesting technology.
The IllumiRoom, which is a Microsoft research project, they're doing some interesting things. Some have rumored said that this will be part of the Xbox 720. That would be a killer feature. The idea that you push a button on the Xbox and it takes over the whole room for the game.
You're in Call of Duty and you're going through with your sniper rifle in the jungle, and the whole living room is a jungle.
That would be pretty awesome.
Well, not even just that, but if all we're doing, we're communicating with like Philips smart bulbs, and simply be able to say, well, why don't we just, we're in the jungle, let's just make the room greener than bluer right now.
Right.
And now we're in space, let's put on some blue lighting effects there. But it really does underscore that. If you're going to be rolling out an update to your game box, really what kind of games it plays and how it enhances the game experience, that almost has to be like the third or the fourth thing you talk about after you talk about what a great living room computer this is going to be and how well it serves your media from other devices and how well it interacts with your real world stuff.
I would like to see television sets replace phones. So that somebody calls and it's a video call on your 41-inch screen TV in HD.
That's not going to work. Because I think that people really have defined the phone as the ultimate personal computer. It's not just a personal computer. It's a private computer. It's, I'm not taking this phone call on the same device that everybody in my family shares. This is my screen, my device. I control the vertical, the horizontal, the up, down, the in, and the out. So I'm not sure people are ready to do that quite yet, apart from, you know, Scott calling your grandparents.
But there are two kinds of communication. One of them is that kind of communication and that kind of computing where it's highly personal, highly individualized, and all that sort of thing. The other thing is like, I spent a lot of time on Google Plus, and the Hangout phenomenon is amazing. And one of the coolest types of Hangouts is something called an ambient Hangout, where you just keep the thing running. So I can see people who are very close to each other. You don't do this for everybody, but just certain people that you're very close with. And you just keep this thing on all the time, and it creates the psychological illusion that you're in the same room, even if you may be in even different countries or something like that. You just keep it running and...
Right. When you put it that way, I definitely can see that sort of thing, but that still requires a little bit of a shift. I mean, I love the fact that throughout most of the show, we're talking about really, really great ideas that are technologically feasible. We have the hardware tech capability, we have the software and the networking capability. What we really need is for people's perceptions and their relationships to their technology and communications to shift just enough to allow them to think about, what if I just had a camera that was open all the time on my living room? So as I'm taking care of the kids, as I'm feeding the dog, as I'm playing a game, people that I select that I would like to share this part of my life with be able to see it.
Well, isn't that your vision for Google Glass too, right?
Well, that's it's more of a discreet on-off sort of thing. There are a lot of times when I would love to. There are times when you take a snapshot of something and you wanted to send it to somebody because someone is getting into roller derby and they might want to know that there is a venue opening up in about 2 months because you just passed by a construction site that's going to have that as one of their opening night things. And the ability to simply not have to stop and explicitly take a thick picture of it, but simply say, "Oh, okay, Glass, take a picture. Now send it to Maura, and you're done. You're continuing to walk." Or sharing an event where you're in the third row at your daughter's recital, and your partner is someplace 300 miles away. They can't be there, but they can actually see it via Hangout. The grandparents, the friends can see it via Hangout. That's a different thing. I mean, but yeah. this idea of my room is next to your room. You can see what's going on in my room. You can hear what's going on in my room. There was a time when the webcams, not the naughty kinds of webcams, but just the plain Jane ones, where someone wanted to see, hey, isn't it cool? I've got enough bandwidth that I can actually keep a webcam going. You know, because there was a time when I would bookmark a couple of those things because it was kind of interesting being a freelancer and having an office of one person where I have this window open where I'm just seeing another person's random activity day after day after day. It was a lot like it gave me sort of the experience of working in a cubicle farm where I don't know necessarily the life of this other person, but I look up and say, oh, I see that Mike got a haircut. Wow, and I'm sure I kind of like it when he had his hair longer. Okay, well, what am I working on right now?
So that's you know what all this is we talked about, and somebody in the chat room will give me the scientific name for the number, but that number that is the upper limit of how many people you could perceive in your tribe, it's 150 people. Yeah. Like you can think of people who are real people to you, but after that 150, it gets a little mushy, and yeah, they're people, but you don't really think of them as people. The Dunbar number, there you go. Thank you very much, chat room. My spare brain helping me out there. And so
if you had Google Glass, you wouldn't have to look at that screen.
Well,
we
exactly.
Just think you remembered it.
Here's the thing: is we are built with wetware that has an upper limit of 150 people in a tribe of 150. I know where to go to get a good place to eat. You know, beyond that, it's when you live in a city of 6 million people, you need enhancement. You need a cybernetic assistant. You need to become more than human in order to properly process this and get, ironically, a more human experience. And likewise, you know, if you're disconnected by physical space, doing like your idea, Andy, of having a virtual room right next door that you could peek in on loved ones and people that you want, you know. What if you entered an age where you had virtual roommates, where it was kind of a big deal, where it's like, hey, man,
I don't want really virtual like roommates.
I mean, you.
I'm
you
a grown up. Like, I don't want roommates at all.
I guarantee
how do I virtually
you,
get rid of my real roommates?
Yeah.
I guarantee you there are thousands of people who that would be an exciting thing. It's like, hey, man, we really like each other. We play this game together. We connect. Oh, we should be virtual roommates and have an always on connection. Again, it's like
a larger point. Yeah, but the larger point you're making, Brian, and the larger point that Andy has made as well, is that Silicon Valley, really the biggest challenge is you have to build a better user, because people are slow to embrace these things. There's so many possibilities, but people just are. It's really,
damn
really
you,
hard.
People. You're so slow.
Yes.
Adopt.
There's a phrase I use a lot, which is after someone pitches me an idea or some really big concept like that, and I say, that's a great idea, but a lot of people are going to have to die first, which does not mean that there's going to have to be a machine gun or anything like that. But it's a lot of people are going to have to age out of the system, and a whole generation is going to have to age in. It's one of the reasons why
that's
I think that
touch takes place.
Like touchscreen computers are going to become a much bigger thing. Once we have a whole generation of kids who are growing up where their very first contact with a computer is not a mouse, not a keyboard, but a touchscreen device, a phone or something like that. And those are the people when they become 10, 11, 12, 13, and they become people that you're going to have to market a computer to, they're going to say, keyboard, what's that? You know, it's a nice accessory. I might buy one of those if I want one later on, but I'm going to need a touchscreen.
So. Yep. Exactly right.
Well, keep in mind, it's so easy for us to look at these things. And first of all, let me just say that this is my favorite tweet that we've ever done. Because how long has it been since we've had a whole bunch of stories that were all about big ideas that we didn't know?
I love that
change
stuff.
Society or not? This is a great time.
Yeah.
But
by the way, our job in a way is to. And if I were Silicon Valley, I'd really promote shows like ours, because really what we're about is kind of saying, "Come on, people, this is interesting stuff. You might want to try this." We are here to push this envelope forward, I think, Andy.
Yep. Well, and the weird part is we're going to put these ideas out there, and we can all speculate on where it's going to go and what the future is going to hold for us, but it's really not even up to us. It's like all of us are too old to matter. It's going to be my 8-year-old daughter, her perception of the Google Glass. Is she going to be more overwhelmed with how cool it is to have an always-on connection, or is she going to be more grossed out by having this, you know, Borg-like thing on your face? And it's them who are going to decide what the future holds. So it's like there's some part of me that's like, I mean, it's like I dig it, but you know, let's just sit back and see what the world says.
Scary aspects to all this, and probably the scariest of which is that if everybody has Google Glass or an iWatch or something like that, and a constant stream of instant information that's preemptive and comes at you all the time, and it's always contextual, and any question can be answered. What's the value of knowledge? Knowledge has no value.
Knowledge has value. Facts have no value. Facts have become a commodity, but understanding and knowledge have become much more valued because of that.
Knowledge is you're confusing. Knowledge is the data. The thing. Would you rather have random access where you can instantly grab it in your brain, or would you rather have magnetic storage on the internet where you have a 3-second lag between you wanting to access it and it being out there?
I set my father-in-law up with an iPad a year or two ago, and he was just blown away. And he was playing with one of the Planets apps, and he said, if Copernicus had this, he wouldn't have had to do all those observations. He could have just played with it and said, I think we revolve around the sun. The facts weren't what was important about what Copernicus did, but he had to spend 90% of his energies gathering the information so that he could – we just lost Mike. We'll get him back. So that he could make the analysis that really changed the world. And so I think that's what's so exciting about this. The facts have become – commonplace. Yeah. They're everywhere.
I spent so much of my math education as a kid learning how to do square roots manually. Right. Whereas kids being taught right now, they know that if I don't need to know what the square root is, I will tap some things into a thing that costs about $3 at any drugstore. But the great thing about the software and the technology is that you can now teach these kids, here is what a cosine function wants. I want you to understand the function of an integral, not just know how to do it. I want you to understand that when you see a collection of data, this is when you see a function, here is what an integral will let you do to it, and will let you understand the curve.
The best example of this, have you guys seen this Dragon Box app on the iPad where it secretly teaches algebra to 8-year-olds? Have you seen this?
No, but I got to get it because I've got an 8-year-old. No, I don't.
This is.
But I never did learn algebra, so.
So the way the Dragon Box app starts off is that it's a game where you have cards and you have two boxes and it deals out a bunch of cards. And your object is to get rid of all the cards on one box except for the Dragon Box. And there's rules. For example, each card has a light side and a night side. And when you put a night side card on top of a face-up one, it vanishes or becomes a vortex that you get rid of. But whatever you do on one side, you have to do on the other side. And so you master that. And then it starts adding the idea like, well, some of these are stuck together. And to get rid of those two, you have to draw a line and put an underneath one. And again, whatever you do on the left side, you have to do on the right side. And then at some point, after you're playing this game, it starts replacing the cards. Instead of being pictures of dragons and teddy bears or whatever, they start throwing like fives and fours. Ooh. And then negative C's. And then at some point they replace the Dragon Box with the letter X. And all of a sudden you realize that you're solving for X. Wow. And then finally it drops the two sides and instead starts expressing everything algebraically using the proper form. My 8-year-old daughter just finished the entire thing. I promised her if she could finish all 100 exercises and get 3 stars on each, I would make her a plaque to put on the wall saying that she learned algebra at 8 years old.
You are sneaky.
She already got it, man. It's amazing. I can't even put into words how much fun. I went back and did it because I just wanted to remember how this stuff is. And the gamification of learning is one of the most advances, the biggest advances in my lifetime.
So this is kind of like Cut the Rope or Angry Birds. You're playing a game that seems like you're solving problems, physics problem, that kind of thing. But in fact, you're learning math.
Yeah. In fact, here, I'll go. I actually have here. Here we go. So this is one of the later levels here. I don't know if you can actually see it on here.
Yeah, we can see it.
There we go. It says, I just mastered the basics of algebra. So let me go.
So they admit it. They admit it.
Yes, finally. So if I play, I'm going to jump forward to one of the early ones here. And I guess I'll go back near the beginning. When you go back near the beginning, the initial things are here. I'll just pick one of these at random. So in this case, you got a bunch of different cards. Some of them are on top of each other. And so you got to figure out how to.
Oh, I get it. You're getting the box on one side.
Yeah, correct. And then in fact, and then later on, let me see if I can actually go out to one of the later ones where once you're actually solving for X in a real algebra setup. Here we go. We'll do this. I'll do one of these last ones here. You see, by the end, now all of a sudden it's a over five plus X equals negative C. And so you know, again, you start figuring out what you need to do. So here we're going to get rid of the five on this. We'll do this there. We'll pop this over here. And this is stuff my 8-year-old did on the live stream. There we go. And then we'll do negative A there.
You did a live stream?
Yeah, we did it. We did it just the other day. It was fantastic. I'm telling you, these guys are shaping the future education because by gamifying it, like she got it instantly. Yeah. There you go. And I solve for X and then I'm done. It's amazing.
Buy 12 more denominators for only $1.99 in that purchase.
It's a $5 game. You pay.
Take all my money if that's what it takes to get my kid to an algebra.
The question is, and this is just like one of those beard stroking questions where I hope that I hope that the kids can take away everything they need to know about that subject, and they don't wind up like 3 or 4 or 5 years later when they expect all math and all engineering and all physics to be fun. But this is not like a game. It isn't like a game. You're actually placing an order for cubic yards of cement to finish this patio that you're helping to design. There is not a little dancing orange that comes by to help you. You have to sit down.
But it doesn't matter. By that point, you've already crafted the neural pathways, and now
that's what I think.
Now you're trying to earn money, and the fact that you've already had experience with this starting a decade earlier makes a big difference. I think this is.
Very subtle, but what it's really teaching you is the understanding of cancellation and all of that. And you learn it. It doesn't matter that it's not numbers initially, and it is numbers. It's in your head. Exactly. You've got the neural pathways. Yeah. And by the way, I'm playing it right now. So is a different thing, but you don't mind. I'm just going to. Yeah. It's easy at first.
It really is. And what's funny is they do, as you expect with games, one of the beauties of video games is that it's one of the few institutions where your reward for doing better is for problems to get harder. And so by gamifying it, they've essentially created by taking advantage of what games have done for 20, 30 years, they essentially make it to where you keep learning more and more complicated algebra problems. And it's fantastic, man.
Yeah. Well, there's also the way that that slot machines sort of train the brain into a certain behavior that's productive for the casino by regulating the release of certain chemicals inside your brain. So you're not necessarily solving the statistical problem of blackjack. You're not necessarily solving a certain matching and pattern problem of a video slot machine. You are simply doing what you need to do to get that next shot of happy juice into your brain. So I think I'm not disagreeing with you on anything that you're saying. I think this is a great game. I just again this is why I bracket this with the HTML tag beard stroking, because there's nothing that can ruin anything more than say yeah. But what if you're instead of giving the kids the happy response of I have learned something new, I understand something I didn't understand before, I've solved this problem that would have baffled me just a week ago, and you're saying but wait a minute, I'm supposed to feel very very happy right now because there's supposed to be more points involved.
I'm feeling now, very happy now, just now by getting instead, 3 stars.
All I've done is figured out how many boards feet of maple I need.
Leo's going to be learning algebra.
Exactly. He's just going to be pulling that slot machine. He's got like 2 cigarettes going, 4 slots machines going. They're going to have to drag him out of the casino after he's sold his Ford Sync for another round of roulette.
I'm stuck, Brian. How do I solve this one?
Cancel out those sixes. You got sixes on the right hand.
Yeah,
side.
They cancel out, huh? How do I do that? Oh, right, with this. Yeah. Now they cancel. Now they cancel. Cards.
I'll never learn math.
Math is hard. Just like that episode of The Next Generation you played that clip from, where even Dr. Crusher was like, all you have to do is let the machine go on its own.
The machine.
Score another point.
All right, we're going to take a break. We are in Barcelona thanks to Mr. Mike Elgin. We got him back, and we're going to find out what's coming up. Mobile World Congress, already Samsung with a few announcements. And I think so far HTC might have the best Android phone out there. They announced the HTC One this week, not in Barcelona, and it looks really sweet, but we'll talk about that in just a bit. Right now I want to tell you about Gazelle. I'll tell you, the math on this one's pretty straightforward. Your gadget, your doodah, Your thingamajig is not getting more valuable. It's getting less valuable every day. If you think a new hot phone is coming, here's what you do. Go to gazelle.com and get a quote for your old phone right now so that you at least have the quote. Well, they will lock these quotes in. Let's say, okay, you got the HTC 8X, and you're thinking, I want the new HTC One. How much can I get for my 8X? You just go in here. You're going to calculate the quote. All right, $171 now. Here's the beauty part. That's good for 30 days. You don't have to cash that in yet. In fact, you might want to go back and say, you know, I got an old iPad. Certainly a second generation iPad isn't worth very much. Let's just check it out and see what that's worth. $240. This is better than gambling. So what we're going to do is we're going to add all these to a box. Once you've got everything in your closet, everything in your drawers, and you piled it all up, Gazelle will send you the box, postage paid on anything worth more than a buck. You send it in. Their data experts will wipe the data. You don't have to worry about even thinking about that. And then they'll send you a check, PayPal credit, or an Amazon gift card. In fact, the pro tip on this is get that Amazon gift card, because if you shop a lot at Amazon, it's well worth it. They bump the price 5%. So this is just fantastic. Now, go to gazelle.com. Take a look at what they'll buy. iPhones, a variety of cell phones, including BlackBerries, a lot of Samsung, Nokia phones. You got an old AT&T Nokia Lumia 920. You ready to get that Windows 8 phone? Let's say it's only in good condition because but it is free of water damage. Let's calculate how much that's worth. It's kind of fun. This is that gambling thing. They should have a little thing that goes ding 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 ding. $189. Boom. Gazelle.
Well, you say they should add a randomizer, so it's like you never know what you're going to get, and then you got that instinct. You're like, let me sell more stuff.
Let's do it again. Sell more stuff. Gazelle has, over the last couple of years, paid $50 million, half a million customers. We're one of them. We sell our stuff all the time on Gazelle, and I invite you to do the same. Gazelle. Really, what you're doing is recycling, making sure somebody who wants that device gets it while you get the latest and greatest. That's why they came to the Twit audience. They know. They know you. You guys don't sit on phones for 5 years. Gazelle.com. Why use a third-generation iPad when you could have a fourth-generation iPad? Let's just see what that... I really should get rid of this. $290. Let's get it. Gazelle.com. Sell that old stuff and buy the new stuff. We lost Mike again, huh? We're going to get him back. Barcelona. This has got to be the trade show everybody in the tech press wants to go to because it's in Barcelona. But also, Mobile World Congress has become one of the most interesting shows. As more last year, Nokia, Microsoft announced Surface there. Already, we've seen 2 8-inch Android tablets. The Samsung Galaxy Note 8 announced today, I think, in advance of Mobile World Congress. HP said, we're going to make an 8-inch as well. The Galaxy Note 8 is kind of interesting. In Europe, it will have a phone on it. So this is what I've been saying. Apple should make a Mac Mini with phone. Samsung's doing it. It's got the S Pen.
The pen is going to be a really interesting differentiator. I mean, Android tablets have been kind of useless because they haven't been a lot of pieces of software that really take advantage of the larger form factor.
Right.
But a Samsung device with an S Pen, this really cool, responsive, sensitive, precise pointing device. It's the reason why I really like the Note 2. And why I find myself using it a lot more than I would like to admit to.
As the host of MacBreak Weekly, you best not say anything.
I prefer to call it a proof of concept for how wonderful an iPad with a stylus would be.
I want this to be a phone, but not in the U.S. I guess the carriers still are pretty powerful in the U.S. So, Mike, you're in Barcelona because you just want to be in Barcelona. Who wouldn't?
Yes.
One of the great cities in the world.
Yeah, and a radically underappreciated city. I think this is genuinely one of the great cities of the world.
Yeah, well, all the Gaudi stuff and the beautiful buildings, the people, the fact that you don't have dinner till 10 o'clock at night and it's got paella.
That's right.
But are you going to go to the Mobile World Congress?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I already went to the I was very disappointed to go to the media reception tonight.
Yeah.
It's tonight here. It was the main sponsor was HTC, and I was hoping to see an HTC One, and they didn't even have a table. I mean, they weren't even present. Yeah, it was really disappointing. But I think that I expect that this show will be similar in some respects to CES, in that there's going to be a big showing by the alternative operating systems for mobile and also the alternative hardware vendors. So, for example, there are some Chinese handset vendors that are ascendant as we speak.
Huawei,
Lenovo, of course.
Huawei,
TCE, and also
XTI.
Coolpad. I think.
Coolpad.
Yeah. Actually, most people don't realize that Coolpad is actually a larger handset maker in China than Apple.
Ooh.
Apple is actually number six now in terms of overall handsets. And these Chinese companies are taking over fast. In Africa, in Kenya, for example, probably 60% of the smartphones and smartphones were growing like crazy there, taking over from feature phones, were Huawei phones. And you see billboards everywhere. They're going after their strategy in China, and then their strategy in Asia, and now their strategy in the whole world, and next their strategy in the United States, is always to go after the very, very low end and then grow it up until they're dominant.
Isn't that what Korea did a few years ago with LG and Samsung? And now look who's number one.
That's exactly right. And now they have the manufacturing power of being a Chinese company.
Hey, they make everything anyway. Why don't they just sell it themselves?
That's right. You can hire a designer. You can do all that stuff. And I fear that we're facing a future where smartphones will become less interesting because, to a very large extent, they'll be commoditized. Right. They'll all have the same features, and everybody will buy on price. And so companies in a world like that, companies like Huawei and ZTE are really going to do well. There's also these alternative operating systems like Tizen, if I'm saying that right.
Yeah, Tizen. Samsung owns that, right?
Samsung and Intel are working on it as a sort of an open platform, but it's really a Samsung-driven
Linux-based.
It's Linux-based, but it's kind of scary that it's a Samsung thing because, of course, Samsung is probably the poster child for innovation in the Android space.
Right.
So it's kind of going to be interesting. So I expect to see a lot of Tizen activity going on. There should be handsets running that operating system later in the year.
I think this is Samsung's way of saying Apple, Google, you don't own us. We could always start making Tizen phones.
Well, they really want to be more like Apple and not just be a hardware vendor because, you know, I think they see the writing on the wall. We're going toward this commoditized, low-cost hardware world where phones are very cheap. The hardware is very inexpensive, and they don't want to see their margins shrink to nothing as a hardware vendor. So they want the software services. They want to have downloadable content. They want to be like Apple, and who wouldn't?
Well, that's what I think HTC is doing with the One. This is clearly HTC saying we're going to make a premium phone that's made. It looks like an iPhone 5. It's made of metal, not plastic. They are doing their own very almost Metro-like UI. HTC Sense 5 has no drop shadows, no gradients. It's square. It's clean. It's a very high-res 1080p, 4.7-inch screen and a machined aluminum unibody. This is clearly a high-end phone aimed at that non-commoditized market that Apple has been so good at getting.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that people miss the thing about this phone that is the most Apple-esque quality, which is that it's one phone. HTC is actually one of the first Asian companies to move from a world in which, we have 50 phones, one for every imaginable demographic, to the Apple model of like, here is the phone.
Yep.
This is the one phone. And that, I think, is a powerful change, and it's something that I'd like to see other companies embrace. This is the best phone we could possibly make, and it's for everybody. That's how Apple does it, and it really works.
Yeah. I mean, it's good to see. It offers a certain amount of clarity for consumers because a company has to say, we're not going to simply make every phone imaginable. We're telling you this is the best phone you can have right now. We believe it so much that we're actually putting all of our resources behind this one device. On the other hand, it also means that will one phone really make so many people that happy? I think that Samsung takes this to a ridiculous degree because now they have, is it now five different phone sizes?
Everything from 4 inches to 12 inches or something.
But they certainly benefited from the fact that they had a rational size, an iPhone-like phone, a 4.8-inch phone, and then they were able to take a risk on something the size of the Note 2. And then when everyone said, wow, we really love this Note 2, they can say, oh, what about these other phones? We didn't actually build those. See, because we had this right all along. It is a gamble. But if they guess right, then it's going to pay off really big for them.
One thing that's interesting about... Go ahead.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Leo. Yeah, okay, it's less of a gamble because there are so many companies doing the Samsung model and so few companies doing the Apple model that it actually makes sense for some second company to try the Apple model. In a world where everybody was doing the Apple model, it would be a terrible idea. But in fact, it's very, very difficult to be an Android handset maker and differentiate. And this is
well, here's another very interesting differentiation. HTC is going to have a 4-megapixel camera.
Smart.
I think this is really smart because what they said is, remember Apple used to say this, the megahertz myth? Now Samsung saying it's the, or HTC saying it's the megapixel myth. Yes.
Well, especially because all you guarantee yourself is that your file sizes will be inordinately large.
Manizel.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sizelmanizel.
Well, what they're saying is, you know, they're not making bigger sensors when they're adding megapixels. They're just making smaller and smaller pixels, and that just means lower and lower quality. This is going to be much better low light performance. It's an f2.0 lens, and the pixel size at 4 megapixels is higher. I think what they're saying, which I think is really smart, is it's the computation power, not the number of pixels, that are going to make the difference in a camera. This could be the best camera out there at 4 megapixels. It remains to be seen.
It's going to deliver the sort of results that people can really absolutely see. They're not necessarily going to be able to, when they look at a picture from a camera, from a camera phone, they're not necessarily going to be able to see that, oh, well, I can actually sense that the woman crossing in the background of the street scene is wearing a checked pattern coat instead of a solid pattern coat. They're definitely going to notice that in a room with not great lighting, there's actually texture on the wall behind the people who are standing there. And all these manufacturers, Apple no less than any other, is figuring out that they're bumping their heads against the limitations of how good an image you can pull out of a camera that's only this thick. One of the best and probably worst surprises of the iPhone 5 was that a phone that's noted for having the best picture-taking ability of any phone out there made only a marginal improvement over went out before in a field in which they got spanked in low-light performance by the Lumia 920, and their closest competitors are doing pictures that are very nearly as good. It's hard to produce a situation in which the iPhone 5 is going to produce a notably better image than a lot of the competition out there. So they're going to have to dig deeper into bags of tricks right now, such as we're going to compromise on the megapixel count for a better quality image. You might even see Apple decide that, well, you know what? What if we were to, oh my God, forgive us, Lord, for speaking this name in vain, but make a phone that's maybe 3 millimeters thicker than the last year's model, because we're going to need to do something to create better image performance than what we have right now.
Mike, what are you looking forward to at MWC? Tell us, I presume the Samsung S4. And there's going to be Firefox OS phones. Ubuntu OS will probably have a presence there. Tell us a little bit about what you're looking forward to.
Well, I don't think Samsung is going to have going to be announcing a whole lot of new stuff. I mean, maybe I could be completely wrong about that, but I think they're going to try. You know, they're the kind of company that's going to want to sort of set their own agenda and get away from the noise and make their own announcements at a later date. But I'm really looking forward to these alternative platforms. It's really a new world, because we currently live in an iOS and Android world, clearly, and that's where all the action is. And now we have all these players, 5 new platforms, that are going to be vying for attention. And I think that they're the kind of platforms they're going to want to have a good foothold in Europe, and they're going to be here in a big way. They're all Linux based, but the Firefox OS, I think, is going to be a big thing. And I just think there's going to be the theme of this show, I have the feeling, is going to be, here is all the ways that we can bring down the iOS and the Android empires with alternatives that could be really huge in the future. And everybody's going to be trying some more dramatic things. So that's what I suspect is going to happen at this show, because that's what's happening this year.
All right, we're going to take a break. I thought there'd be more, but I'm back. We're going to take a break. We'll come back. There's some interesting things going on in piracy. The six strikes law goes into effect tomorrow. We'll tell you what you can expect if you continue pirating with your ISP. And there was one other story I thought we should... the NASCAR YouTube video kerfuffle coming up in just a bit. Before we do that, though, let's take a look at what's coming up in the week ahead. Maybe Tom Merritt has something exciting to see.
Hey, thanks, Leo. Here's a look at what's coming up in the week ahead on Tech News Today. These are the stories we'll be following anyway. The sentencing of Andrew Arnheimer, a.k.a. Weave, is expected to take place Monday, February 25th. That's in the iPad email intrusion case. Also on Monday, the Mobile World Congress kicks off in Barcelona and the RSA conference kicks off. Tuesday, February 26th, Lenovo has their ThinkPad Chromebook available to schools. Wednesday, February 27th, Groupon reports their earnings. And Office 365 for Business becomes available. Thursday, February 28th, Sony's Xperia Z pre-orders begin for 3 and O2 users in UK. And the PlayStation Vita arrives in ice silver for folks in Asia. Ooh. And Friday, March 1st, the RSA conference wraps up. That's a look at the week ahead. Back to you, Leo.
Make sure you watch Tech News Today for your daily dose of tech news. Monday through Friday with Tom Merritt, Sarah Lane, Ayaz Akhtar, 10 a.m. Pacific. That's 1 p.m. Eastern Time, 1800 UTC, live on twit.tv. And, of course, you can download it for your commute home. We usually get it out before the end of the business day on the weekdays.
Before noon, we try.
Before noon, our time.
Our time.
Before 3, East Coast time. Before 8 in the evening, if you're living in Great Britain.
Right.
You can do the math for the rest of the countries. I don't know what it is. What time is it in Barcelona right now? It's late.
It's 10 minutes before 2 a.m.
I really am grateful. Mike, you join us, in the middle of the night whenever you join us now. But I'm really...
You know, somebody's got to live in Barcelona and drink sangria. And
thank you.
I volunteered. I'm taking the bullet on that one, Mike. This is really kind of you.
Thank you.
I do what I can.
We'll receive the Order of Lenin for this, comrade.
Six strikes.
Yeah, I'm going to take a break. Wait, let's talk about six strikes because I think everybody should be aware of this. You may be getting re-educated later this month. But first, a word from Citrix. Our friends at Citrix have yet another great product. I think coming up with great stuff. This one is called Go to Assist. If you're in IT, you ought to know about this. Sometimes the IT tools you use to solve problems are more complicated than the problem you're solving. That's not what you need. You need something that helps you get the job done without getting in your way. And this is a complete tool set. GoToAssist started with the best remote access, still used by more people than any other remote access solution. But of late, they've added new modules to make it even more useful. All in the cloud, an entire cloud-based tool set to make you an IT hero. So you got the remote support, Mac, PC, mobile devices. You can, fix anything, anywhere. Unattended support as well as attended support. You can also do an assay of the hardware and software. You can find out what's going on. Now, that's just the beginning. They've got now a new module called Monitoring that lets you monitor all of the things on your client's network. You run the GoToAssist crawler. You'll detect all the hardware and software on the network. And then you can set up a dashboard that will let you know what's going on. So they've got some preset dashboard modules, but you can customize your own. Everything from, network performance loading on the server to a toner cartridge and how full it is, how much hard drive space is left. And then you get alerts via text or email, instant messenger. And so you're always aware of what's going on. Then you can get in there and get that remote support done. Fix the problem before it becomes a big headache. That's the monitoring. And then now also they have a complete service desk solution that lets you track and resolve issues. It also lets you do things like track infrastructure changes, track releases. Really cool. I have to say, this has now become a very sweet tool set. If you're in IT, I want you to try this free for 30 days. Visit GoToAssist.com. Click the Try It Free button. Make sure you check all three modules. You want to try all three modules. Use the offer code TWIT for 30 days free. This is a fantastic solution for anybody in the IT field. GoToAssist.com. Use the offer code Twit. So it's called CAS, C-A-S, and it is a system that virtually all the ISPs in the U.S. have agreed. It's a U.S. version of the three strikes law that Hadoop that they use in France that was proposed in England. Are you excited? Getting ready, Brian?
What is this loaded question you're throwing?
Are you
right
ready for
me,
the
sir?
Copyright? The copyright alert system?
Look, it's okay. So as I understand it, and I'm an idiot who eats fire for a living, but walk me through this.
Yeah, but you know, like, algebra, and I have to respect that.
Basically, once you get six strikes, and then what? You get your ISP card yanked. They won't provide
service. No, you know that, and this is what's unclear. So, Time Warner, AT&T, Cablevision, Comcast, Verizon, all have agreed to implement this. They'll all do it a little bit differently. Starts tomorrow. The problem with Hadoop in France was if you're accused of a copyright crime,
you're guilty.
You're guilty.
Been accused.
That's and it. You get three strikes. And then in France, anyway, you're banned from the internet. This is a little bit different. First of all, it doesn't look like banning. You just have to get re-educated. They will throttle speeds, your data speed. They can if you're – so what they'll do is you'll send you a notice. They'll say, hey, we're going to slow you. You get six strikes. But after strike, I don't know what, two or three, they start throttling your speed. They slow you down. After five or six strikes, they're going to put up a landing page every time you try to use the internet. It says you may not use the internet unless you get re-educated.
Ugh.
And you'll have to...
Re-education camp.
Yeah, you'll have to go to camp. No, they have a... It's an online copyright education plan. They don't say...
Clockwork Orange, a lot of that, only the FBI copyright warning.
Yeah, right.
As an RIA person, just keeps putting eye drops in your eyes.
I just hope they have eye drops. That's all I can say.
Now, sure. Is this a legal thing, or is this a consortium where they have decided that they're all going to sign on for this
behavior code? It's a consortium. Obama, a White House statement was that we think that this is exactly the best way to solve this problem. We don't want to legislate this. We want people to figure out how to do this without bringing the government into bear.
Well, the good news is they are correct about that. However, unfortunately, it's just going to feel just as draconian. Whenever you have a law that does something that prohibits something that everybody wants to do, looking at you, drug war,
So you just want to sit there, get high, and download BitTorrents. Is that what you do?
Okay, hold on. You're putting more words in my mouth, sir. All you get is weaselly activity to dodge the law. You're going to get out of this is savvy people buying VPN services where they have encrypted traffic, and then they'll double down. And now what was a previously relatively transparent BitTorrent marketplace will suddenly go underground. And as you guys know, I'm a reformed bad guy. I used to download all kinds of pirated stuff off of originally BBSs, where you had to build up a relationship, and then you got in, and it was all you could eat buffet of other people's software. Then the internet made it possible to get credits. Eventually, you could get a leech account on somebody's FTP, where it was all you could eat software or whatever. But those were very difficult to track down. BitTorrent is monitorable, and it's relatively transparent. And again, there are ways to shape behavior, but I don't think this is going to work out the way they want. What'll happen is you'll annoy unsophisticated users who probably don't even know that they're doing anything wrong. And so maybe for them it is a good thing. But by and large, anyone who's sophisticated is either going to encrypt their traffic, they're going to VPN it. Nothing's going to change outside of this is an arms race, basically, is what I'm trying to say.
For $35, you can have an independent review process after a few notices. If you still think it's not you.
Oh, you have to pay.
You could pay $35 to have somebody review.
Yeah, now this is a racket. This is how you make money. Let's establish our own judiciary system, and let's make it to where you have to pay $35 for the privilege of saying the words not guilty. Brilliant. Yeah.
That's the problem I have with this, is you're guilty until proven innocent. Yeah.
Well, I think it's not an objectionable idea in principle. I just think that I don't think anybody familiar with this sort of thing is confident that that the stuff being targeted is going to be illegal content exclusively and people who are guilty exclusively. I think that it's an okay idea if it is truly an education system where I think that one of the things that the recording industry is afraid of isn't the people who are just going to figure out a way to get Game of Thrones for free immediately without paying for HBO or DVDs or Blu-rays, no matter what. I think they're more afraid of that guy teaching somebody who is kind of unsophisticated that, oh, well, it's really easy. I don't know why you're paying for HBO. Here's it. You get it. There are no consequences. It's easier. And here's how to do it. Kind of the way that it's now really, 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 really difficult to simply make a color photocopy of a $20 bill and print it on a color printer. You're not going to block the people who are interested in counterfeiting. You are going to block the people who are kind of silly and wanted to do this because, hey, let's see if this will work. So if that's their goal, then that's kind of an okay goal. I also think that you should be paying for Game of Thrones if you think that you are entitled to it. There's some people online who will tell you that, oh, well, just damn them for charging me money for watching something that should be free on television. If you're upset with that, Andy, you shouldn't be. But I think that you should have a system in place so that the people who are being naughty are kind of educated not to be naughty. But you can't restrict the freedom of people who are just going out their normal business.
Let's just let the movie industry speak for itself. Here is a little video they've made on the copyright alert system process.
Here's how content owners know what's being shared over peer-to-peer networks and how a copyright alert makes its way to subscribers. Content creators join public peer-to-peer networks and use keywords to locate and identify digital files of music, movies, or TV shows they own. Once they see a song or video being shared, they confirm that it's the entire song, movie, or TV show, not just a portion of it. In order to confirm that the file is an entire copy, it is downloaded and reviewed. For example, in the case of a movie, watches key pieces and records information about the video file, creating a unique digital identifier called a hash.
After content owners confirm that the content has been shared over a peer-to-peer network without authorization,
they identify the internet protocol or technical address of the computer or account sharing the file.
This is where the
each internet protocol address is assigned to an internet service provider or ISP. Content owners notify that ISP, and the ISP determines which subscriber's account was assigned the address at that time. The ISP then passes the information or alert on to the subscriber. No personal information about the subscriber is shared with the content owners at any point. Content owners save the information they've collected to ensure accuracy and have the evidence needed if the subscriber chooses to challenge an alert. The copyright alert system is designed to discourage illegal content sharing on peer-to-peer networks and promote legal sources of digital content. Please support the creative work we all love by accessing and sharing it legally.
On pea-colored computers.
All the pirates are using yellow. Computers.
Here's what I don't understand. You're telling me all of these ISPs can get together on the same page to create this kind of draconian thing, but they can't all get together on the same page to create some kind of revenue sharing opportunity to where part of your ISP fee is that you buy into a general fund that acts like a BMI ASCAP type of thing and distributes the funds according to whatever is being downloaded the most. It's like there are better ways than what we're doing right now. And something that smacks of draconian 20th century methodology, it just stinks, just smells bad. It may even be a good idea, and I'm not going to blame you, but it's like you got a smelly way of going about it, gentlemen.
Well, what I'm curious about is what if I'm watching? I love watching the capture videos from Beatles Rock Band, like some great music videos for Beatles songs. But technically, I'm listening to an entire Beatles song on YouTube. Does that count as a strike? If you're watching a Google Hangout and somebody has music playing in the background, does that count as a strike? So I'm not confident from past performance that they're going to do this in such a way that, once again, people who are trying to, if the system is perfectly designed to only trap people who are trying to get away with not paying for stuff they should be paying for, then that's fine. But that's not going to be how it's going to work.
The thing, and Brian was talking about how it's going to be an arms race where the sophisticated users are going to figure out how to get around this. One of the ways they're going to figure out how to get around this is to spoof the addresses and sort of make their own activity appear to be some innocent person's activity.
Yes. And now all of a sudden it's going to be a way that you screw over this jerk who cut you off on the 405. You find out his IP address and you mess up you corrupt his account basically.
Or you do it randomly. But anyway, I suspect that the sophisticated users are going to, the obvious way to get around this is to have is to be somebody else, is to spoof another person's identity somehow.
But this is just like, you know, the first three or four reels of like Goodfellas, where the kid just I just want to run errands for the local crime boss, and then now I'm just delivering packages for the local crime boss. These people saying, all I want, I'm just frustrated that I can't see Game of Thrones for a year until it gets released. So I thought, what's the harm? And then we're up to, I have to spoof. There's a monastery two doors away that has an unsecured Wi-Fi. If I download it from their parking lot, then the monks will get shut down and not me.
Exactly. That's exactly what's going to happen.
So this is another story that I thought had a more appropriate conclusion, although a very sad story. Did Danica Patrick, is Daytona over? Did she win?
Yeah. Eighth place.
Eighth place. Okay. Eighth place. Yesterday, and I guess these were qualifying or events yesterday, but of course a horrific crash on Saturday. And somebody in the very near to where that tire landed.
Exceptional footage.
Yeah.
This is what you're going to get more of with Google Glass is unbelievable. You can count on getting a lot more awesome footage like this and horrific.
Horrific. So the car broke through the barrier, and the engine and a tire and a lot of debris flew up into the crowd. And there are some people who are very seriously injured. I think somebody with life-threatening injuries. But the point is, this video, fan shot video, was posted on YouTube. And NASCAR pulled it down, claiming copyright violation. Now, really, it's not a question of copyright violation. Later, NASCAR said, well, we felt bad for the victims. We didn't think it was appropriate for them to see that video, which I understand. But again, not a reason to pull it down. Google decided to put it back up. And I think that was the right thing. They reinstated the video. They said NASCAR had overstepped its bounds, that in fact it was not a copyright violation.
Well, what did they overstep their bounds by claiming copyright for something that clearly they didn't own the copyright to that happened at a public
How
event?
How could that be?
Oh, what a bold decision, well, Google. Congratulations.
Yeah. Well, they said the justification they use is that when you purchase a ticket to this event, it's in that microscopic print that, of course, everybody reads before they enter the venue. They say that, well, if you take pictures, you can do it for your personal use, but we essentially own license the rights to it. So they're saying that, well, because of a shot on a NASCAR event, technically we own that property, and so that's how we're going to.
Well, that's probably true. If I took pictures of the Super Bowl, the NFL could say, well, you can't put that up. Although they don't usually, as a practice, do that.
Yeah, exactly.
Obviously, you could say that NASCAR was trying to protect the sensibilities of the victims' families, trying to protect NASCAR and maybe not hurt ticket sales to future events.
In the chat room, they're calling me out right now as a libertarian. They say, well, if that's a contract, then you should be okay with it. I guess I am.
And you did agree. But there is also an overriding, I think, social interest, because this is news footage. And so there is an overriding interest that society might have, even though strict copyright law may say, you know, you can't take a picture of that riot in that mall because you're in a mall. It's not a public place. But there is an overriding interest from the point of view of news footage.
Yeah. And people should be at least savvy enough to realize that they're not going to be able to control this for more than about 10 seconds. Right. So they may as well let it be posted. I don't think anybody would doubt that the reason why they wanted to spike that video is because it showed something horrific happening to this, what's being promoted as a very family friendly, fun American pie sort of event. And without acknowledging that maybe sometimes the carnage that happens in the field is going to actually sort of sneak up into the grandstands. But I mean, how many times have we seen that phrase, we have no comment because we wish to protect the privacy of the 9-year-old wheelchair-bound cancer patient whom we decided to strip search in public on our TSA line. That's a line that really has to be banished from all PR handbooks from now on, because nobody's buying it.
Matthew Ingram, writing in paid content, points out that this is an example of the fact that DMCA favors the copyright holder. It was pulled down automatically due to the DMCA. Yes, Google reversed it, but really what we have a right to see and what is okay is really determined by these massive companies. And Jillian York of the EFF and others, Jason Ponton of the MIT Technology Review, say that our speech is to a large degree controlled by private corporations. And I think that that's a good, a very good point.
Okay, well, if you're using the private corporation's resources to communicate, then use your own, use your personal. Or,
but okay, here's an example. I mean, Twit does, this is private and we do it, nobody controls us. But still, we have to use the public internet and companies like Ustream and Justin.tv and others to get out there and YouTube. They could really shut us down if they wanted to, right?
There's a difference between YouTube shutting you down and like your ISP shutting you down. And there's a difference between your ISP shutting you down and every ISP shutting you down. So I think that I have a little problem with the amount of service that you're getting from YouTube doesn't include a promise from them that they're going to post anything you post and they're going to keep it up indefinitely. So I think they were wrong. But again, I think that the limitations to what we expect a corporation to do for you to continue to do when it's a free service you're not paying anything for.
Yeah, as far as the NASCAR thing, like if there really is a contract with every single ticket and they really have covered their backsides on that and then they said they didn't want to do it, I'm not going to fault them for being outside of bounds, but I am going to say that was a phenomenally stupid move for them to make. And this is one of the things I like about private companies being involved, because look how quickly that when they see the way public sentiment turns against them, corporations have a dollar reason to instantly flip around where you don't get that with government. So if I'm going to have to choose between, gatekeepers, I'd rather be a big corporate than government.
Yeah. Well, that's true. And also we don't necessarily know what the thinking process went at Google. It's possible that there is a latency problem and when they need to reverse a decision, that it wasn't that, there's a huge outcry. It's just that maybe it's possible there was just a period of time that has to go before a human being has to look at a highly automated decision and say, that shouldn't have happened. Okay, we'll just hit the undo button on that and move forward. But I agree with you.
I'm sorry. I'm just doing some algebra here. Don't mind me.
You're stuck. You're sucked into the dragon box.
In the casino. You're just a rat hitting that lever trying to get the food pellet.
I put that there and I put that there.
Dude, I just want to point out
there was a time when we used to get into math because we were nerds, not because it was fun.
Indianaco is making the case that apparently algebra is sold out and now anyone can do it and it's no good anymore.
Anybody can do it now. Yeah.
I did my math on acoustic, on a slide rule, mister. None of this electronic mumbo jumbo. It's not a guy on stage with a laptop. It's a guy with chalk dust in his beard at a blackboard.
Yeah. Mathematicians.
It was miserable. And we hate it. And you have to hate it, too.
We're going to wrap this up. Let Mike go to bed in Barcelona in just a moment. But first, if you missed anything on Twit, you might have missed this.
Previously on Twit, Windows Weekly.
You know, this Chromebook doesn't actually look that beautiful. It's very boxy.
I know, it's boxy.
That price.
It's boxier than the first Lenovo Titanium PowerBook.
Looks like from years
ago.
Yeah.
It is not a pretty machine. I give them a little credit for being so weird, but this is weird.
This Week in Computer Hardware.
Like, it's got an Ivy Bridge processor in it. So, I'm running web apps. Why do I need to have an Ivy Bridge part in it?
All about Android.
So you've got your boom sound with your Ultra Pixel in your Blink feed. So a lot of buzzwords with the HTC One there.
But they're not going to have a hard time marketing this.
Twit Live specials.
I think 4K support for games will be through probably a similar upscaling engine that they have in their Blu-ray players and their televisions. To make maybe a game that's a little over 1080p or is native 1080p, because most of our PS3 games are upscaled to 720 or 1080 right now anyway.
Twit. Tech just like you like it.
This was a good week if you're into tech, and we covered it all. And I hope you watch next week because there'll be a lot more to talk about. Mike Elgin is in Barcelona for Mobile World Congress. We'll stay in touch. We'll find out what you think are the big stories from MWC. Maybe we can get you on another one of our shows later in the week.
Sounds great.
Thank you, Mike. Thanks for staying up late with us. MikeElgin.com, or just go to Google+ and circle him for a bunch of great content and also Computer World and elsewhere.
Yes.
Thank you, Mike.
Wherever fine columns are sold.
Thank you to Andy Iannacco. You look great with that new computer and the new camera and everything. It's just beautiful.
What kind of camera is that? We didn't establish this before the show started.
That is a humble Logitech 920. as a matter of fact.
You know what we did? We bought him a dedicated Mac Mini. You upgraded to Fios, right?
I upgraded to like the Ninja Fios, the basic download Spock consciousness and put it into a new brain bandwidth. And the A plus B plus a new camera, plus these cool studio lights I put in about a few weeks ago, a few months ago. Seems to positive. And also the squirrel.
Squirrel?
The presence of a squirrel usually is a good squirrel. Thing. Keeping an eye on things.
Squirrel.
I would like the squirrel to be like, you know, like on the BBC, like test card, the girl with the rag doll. This is like the test card. If you can see the squirrel's whiskers, you know that the bandwidth is working, the compressor is working, everything's working.
It does. It looks great. And actually, I think Brian looks awfully good. Brian Brushwood. From a scam thank you. School.
That's all digital enhancement. I'm actually an 85-year-old beast.
But you're using like a DSLR to do this, which is kind of interesting.
Well, and having to de-interlace it and everything, it's coming out okay. It's like the first time we hooked it up, it's like, wow, on the 920, it looks like NSFW show. But on these, it looks like the art. Movie about the NSFW show.
It looks like the Ken Burns documentary about the show.
Well, you guys, thank you for being here. You enjoy your Oscars celebration. We thank everybody for joining us. We do this show Sunday afternoon, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern time. That's 3 plus 12 is 5 plus 8 is 2300 UTC late at night on the rest of the world. But we do thank you for being here live because it's more fun for us to see the chat room to interact like that. But if you can't watch live on-demand versions and audio and video available on our website, twit.tv, and wherever great internet programming is available for download. Thank you, everybody, for being here. And we'll see you next time. Another twit.
This is on the amazing. Can.
Yay.
Oh, we got a big in-studio crowd.
Big studio audience.